in the matter of abortion that life begins at the moment of foreplay. In the airport, Lyndon LaRouche people with signs that said, mosquitoes don't wear condoms. And at first I didn't understand. I thought he was talking about the mosquitoes in Nicaragua, the tribes. But he was talking about AIDS and how in Africa and Florida there are mosquitoes that actually can transmit the AIDS virus. So I had to assure him that it was only if they shared their needles.
Right.
Well, Lenny Bruce was the one who influenced me the most because he went all the way. You know, he just he balanced on the edge, and then he realized that the edge was infinite.
The second in our two-part series with that wild satirist, Paul Krassner, right now on Alternative Views.
Paul's time was the 1960s, when his unique political journal, The Realist, contained some of the most advanced political satire and comedy of the day. Paul was also one of the founders of the Yippies, an anarcho-absurdist group that got national attention in the 1960s. Well, Yippies became Yuppies, but Paul Krassner lives on.
But before we talk with Paul, here are some news stories from the Alternative Press.
Well, the information on the history of the FBI's COINTELPRO program and the attack on civil liberties by the FBI, this information continues to come out, and it's even more surprising. A North Carolina lawyer and journalist, Alexander Charms, learned from a Freedom of Information Act document that the FBI kept confidential files on the Supreme Court from 1932 to at least 1985. There was over 2,000 pages of files. It reveals that the FBI wiretapped and monitored conversations of the justices, and that the court employees were used as informants as well. Documents show that Chief Justice Earl Warren and Justices William Douglas and Abe Fortas were specifically targeted covertly because they had upheld the rights of communists, according to the FBI. During appeal in the Rosenberg spy trial, the chief of the Supreme Court Security Police, Philip Crook, reported information overheard by his crew, and he kept special FBI agents advised of the arrival and departure of key persons in the case. That's remarkable. It's you remember the program we did about Red Scare, the book Red Scare, with Don Carlson, the author of Red Scare, and he said that the local Red Squads down in Houston in the police department were keeping dossiers not only on progressive or liberal people like Barbara Jordan, but also on the mayor and other civic leaders at the time. Incredible, and yet these FBI and all these people are still in our midst, still doing their bit.
If you could add one or two or three amendments to the Constitution, what would you want?
One, two, three amendments. That the people shall decide which drugs are legal and which are illegal. Let's see, what else? In the matter of abortion, that life begins at the moment of foreplay, I would include that. Dentists would have to experience themselves whatever pain they gave you.
In Palestinian perspective, there is an article by a woman who is a doctor from England. She spent a lot of time in Lebanon and in the occupied territories. She has had some very interesting insights. She said in the summer of 82, when she was in the refugee camps in Lebanon and in Sabra and Shatila, she said, "I discovered the truth that Israel, a country that I had loved and respected all my life, had suddenly turned into a ruthless monster." She had treated some of the children, particularly, who had been hit by some of the weapons that the Israelis had had. She said, "The first child I treated was a victim of a cluster bomb. Thank God he died, because if he'd lived, he'd have had no eyes, no face, no legs." She treated hundreds, thousands of children in coming in equally as hurt. Well, then later she went to Gaza, and when she was in Gaza, she was treating Palestinians, and she went to a prison and noticed that in the Gaza Central Jail, the prisoners were put 25 to each cell, often having to sleep on top of each other. To be found with a Palestinian flag, to be suspected of opposing the occupation by Israel, would earn long prison term. Never mind throwing rocks at the Israelis. She said that most of her patients had either been beaten up by the army, the Israeli army, or had been shot by them. The abbreviation BBA, which means beaten by the army, appeared regularly on the medical records. There were patients with gunshot wounds carried to the emergency room by terrified relatives, little children, 5, 6, 7 years of age, teenagers, 13, 12 years of age. Occasionally, the army, just for a little variety, they would shoot around the kids instead of directly at them. And in their panic, they would try to climb over walls. And then when they got up on the top of the walls, the army would start shooting around them then. And then the kid would get away from the shots there, they'd jump off the walls. And when they jumped off the walls, then they would break their legs and arms. And then they would come to her, and she would try to treat them. And the Israelis would write down, "fallen off the wall while trying to escape from the army." She said she treated Palestinians with nasty high-voltage burns sustained as a result of being forced to take Palestinian flags, which had been put up on electric poles. The army had ordered the Palestinians to remove the Palestinian flags. It ties in with something in Harper's Magazine, a little section called Readings, in which it was reported people who saw Henry Kissinger in a kind of a secret meeting with the major American Jewish organization. He gave them advice on what Israel should do and what they should do. First of all, he said the Jews in the United States should not criticize Israel. But then he said Israel should bar the media from entry into the occupied territories, and then accept the short-term criticism of the world press for doing that, and then to put down the insurrection as brutally, overwhelmingly, and quickly as possible. Then he said they could ride out the bad press for a while and it would be all right. That's Henry Kissinger's formula for a lot of things, isn't it?
And as Henry Kissinger said, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac.
I have another story on Kissinger and his response to the brutal suppression of the Chinese Movement for Democracy in Tiananmen Square. Right after this brutal suppression that shocked the American people and the entire world, Kissinger was constantly on American television saying that he was aghast that Congress had voted to impose sanctions against China. He was constantly saying we had to accept the repression, that we had to understand Deng Xiaoping and the Chinese government. We had to keep our normalized relations with China. We couldn't risk losing this special relation that was developing. And the Nation magazine points out that at the same time that Kissinger was making these statements on behalf of the Chinese government, he was receiving fees in excess of $200,000 per year or per client for advising such corporations as Shearson Lehman, Hutton, Atlantic Richfield, H.J. Heinz, Union Carbide, Chase Manhattan Bank, Coca-Cola, and American Express. Each one of these countries does business with China. Each one of them wants to build more factories, to do more business, and this requires good relationships with the Chinese government. So at the same time that Kissinger is defending the Chinese government for their indefensible and brutal actions, he's on the payroll of all of these corporations. So the next time you see Kissinger on a television spouting off something about China, remember his own stake in U.S.-Chinese trade. It's just disgraceful that the networks like Ted Koppel on Nightline let him on so much in these talk shows, because he's a paid operative of these big corporations who has heavy interests in all of the things that he's making commentaries on.
What, in your opinion, will best bring about peace?
If we eliminate the bad guys.
Well, where but in Texas would more kids get beaten by the teachers and the principals? And Dallas is right at the heart of it. There was a big article in the Dallas Times Herald, which is very good, indicating that hundreds of more than the 131,000 Dallas students get spanked every day. And according to the Texas law, they don't even have to ask, get the parents' consent before they start beating on the kids. Now, this is required by the policy of the Dallas Independent School District. As a matter of fact, if some principals don't report that they are spanking kids and how many of them they are, they get into trouble. As one official said, must be some difficulty here. I can't imagine them not having any problems with the kids down there. How come they're not whipping them, you know? Well, the principals and assistant principals can spank kids even if their parents request they don't. Children are not given a chance to tell their side of the story. There are no guidelines on what kind of instruments are to be administered, where they're to be administered, and with what type of paddle or whatever. But this practice is very thoroughly entrenched in the Texas schools. Only two school districts in the whole state have banned corporal punishment. In 1987-1988, Dallas schools, according to the Dallas Times Herald, reported 6,274 paddlings. And the superintendent for elementary education warned the principals that they have violated the Dallas Independent School District policy if they don't beat their kids. Well, there are some organizations that are against this corporal punishment against kids, even national organizations. The American Medical Association, the National PTA is against it. The American Bar Association is against it, not even to mention organizations like American Civil Liberties Union. Well, the spanking of kids in Dallas, it's kind of at the whim of the principal. Some kids are only spanked for more serious things like fighting, but others can be spanked for tardiness or for not doing their homework. The principals and assistant principals say, well, there are some kids who that's all they respond to, because at home, that's the principal means of discipline. And that's the only thing they recognize that will modify or change their behavior. If that's the only thing that happens at home to try to modify behavior, then that's the only thing that kids will respond to. Only two of the board members of the school board in Dallas are against this spanking. One of the people said, who's against it, said, we're being hypocrites. In one instance, we're telling children not to be violent and to physically abuse each other and a teacher,
And yet, we're physically abusing the kids. And the Supreme Court, in an interesting decision, said that it was okay to beat kids in school. There was a case of two little girls, I think they were 8 years old. They were giggling out in the hallway. Well, the principal didn't like that. By God, you're giggling. They took them in. They beat the little girls. And then sent them back to their class. And when they got in class, they got the giggles again, and the teacher spanked them. Well, the poor little girls were traumatized and didn't come back to school for another week or two. The parents took it to court. They were also under a doctor's care. Parents took it to court, and they lost. The trial court held in favor of the parents and against the school. The appellate court ruled against the school and in favor of the parents, but the Supreme Court said, yeah, go ahead. Beat them kids.
The Honorable Judge Paul Krasner has been entrusted with making the punishment fit the crime.
Televangelists. Oh, that was one of my goals, yeah.
Televangelists.
And what's the crime? Do I have to decide what the punishment is? Do I have to decide what the punishment or the crime was? I mean, see, there's a part of, a philosophical part of me that believes that the crime and the punishment are the same process. But, you're not going to stay a judge very long if, you know, because you'll dismiss all your cases that way. So you give me a punishment, I'll give you a crime, and I'll give you a punishment.
If the televangelist appeared before you
okay.
On the bench.
Oh, okay. I would just, well, I guess I would have them as punishment have to watch their own programs just on a tape loop, you know, watch their pitches. I mean, we'll have Gene Scott harangue himself for hours, you know, just to have Jerry Falwell talk about the revelation and the beast, you know, and just have him tied to a chair watching himself doing it. I don't like the force part of it, but, you know, I'm a judge. I can do whatever I want.
Next case in front of your docket, defense contractors.
Defense contractors. I would have them meet the families of everybody who was ever injured by any of the products that they manufactured. That would be their purgatory.
The director of the CIA.
I would just bring him back to life. That would be enough punishment for him.
William Rehnquist.
I would just bring him back to life. That would be enough punishment. What would be appropriate for William Rehnquist? I think that I would...
Make him stay straight?
Do you know something about what goes on under those gowns? I would have William Rehnquist be sentenced to forced prayer in school. You know, I mean, he would have to pray. It would be like forced busing, so that you would bring religious students to non-religious schools back and forth, just for a balance of piety. And he would just have to keep praying and praying and praying. I mean, he could pray for better decisions. He would have the freedom to pray for whatever he wanted, but he would have to pray.
Ed Meese.
Ed Meese would have to give up prayer. He is really a religious fanatic. Ed Meese would have to be a clerk in an all-night pornography store.
Richard Nixon.
He would have to be a customer in an all-night pornography store. I am not a masturbator.
Oliver North.
Oliver North. What would he be?
I think
he would have to whenever a football game was won or a New Year's Eve was being celebrated, he would have to shred all the confetti that people threw out windows. Calendars, that would be his job. He would be the keeper of the shredder. He would have to shred wheat. You know, whatever needed to be shredded, That would be Ali's job.
The Pope, or the Catholic Church, it's, you know.
Well, now we have to deal with individuals here.
Okay.
I mean, you can't condemn an institution because an institution is, you know, have to take their leader. So the Pope...
It's next. Yeah.
I think the Pope would get a job in a factory working with the people on an assembly line, you know, a conveyor belt. His job would be to put condoms on test tubes so that we could have artificial sex but safe.
The Democratic Party.
The Democratic Party. They would have to unionize, I think. Democratic Party. I don't know. I guess they would have to. They would have to face the ghosts of past Democrats and explain to them what they had allowed to happen to the party, and I guess they would have to get into a session of maybe go to a psychodrama and do role playing, and pretend they were Republicans and see if there was really any difference in the way they acted.
The Republican Party.
I think the Republican Party would have to be homeless for 6 months of every year. They just have to live in the streets, and then it would probably affect their voting pattern, I would think.
Last, and of course least, everyone's favorite lame duck. Ronald Reagan.
What he...
Make the punishment fit the crime.
Oh, my. He would have to do a press conference without his hearing aid, which is actually getting the answers from his kitchen cabinet. And so he would have to wing it. He would have to wing press conferences. He would not get any briefings. He would have to explain himself. He would just have to, and then he would have to watch the rushes so that he could see himself as others saw him. And he would have to expose the strings, you know, he's a marionette. That's not too well known, which is why he moves like that, just the strings. And we would have to show who the marionette operator was, you know, and it's a sort of what do they call those big things? Begins with a C. Not what Lenny got arrested for, but it's well, but although they work in these places, they buy things. Conundrums. No, but it's like that. It's like that. Now conundrums are prophylactics that you can't quite get on.
Who do you think is the puppeteer?
Well, it varies. You know, it's some people from the Bechtel Corporation, some people, you know, it's from the liquor industry lobby. It's a sort of a joint operation there, but I think it would be to expose the Wizard of Oz nature of the government, you know, and so that just pulling the curtain from behind Reagan to show who's manipulating the strings, and then let him continue doing it, you know. I mean, but just let it be out front. I would like that, and I would also like to put George Bush in charge of selling clean urine to basketball players.
Well, although it's true that there's been a taboo on social criticism and satire in the media, to some extent there's been something of a rebirth of political humor since the Iran-Contra affair began, at least on the cabaret level. I was in Los Angeles this spring and all of the comedy clubs were having a great time with the Iran-Contra hearings. And more recently I saw on television that in Washington, D.C., there's a lot of political cabarets that have sprung up that have been having great fun, and you've been traveling around.
And
the
there
country.
Was a political political humor forum in Washington, but they have people like Mark Russell, who is sort of the poor person Steve Allen, They have Art Buchwald, who has, you know, lunch with Henry Kissinger. I mean, Mortsaw now is supporting Alexander Haig for the presidency.
Are you kidding?
No, no, this is true. In fact, it was Mortsaw who gave Haig the line, "I'm throwing my helmet into the ring." But if you think about it, Mortsaw has always gone with the power structure. You know, even though he supported John F. Kennedy, he also supported the Bay of Pigs. So, you know, he just became sort of a latter-day Will Rogers. But
well, and yet in the early 60s, you know, he would take on Richard Nixon, and he did a lot of sharp satire on that, that ilk. And then he fell into hard times and has become rather bitter about it because So what happened?
A lot of his performance now. Well, a lot of his performances is based on name dropping, how he got invited to have dinner with the Reagans at the White House, and how all the Hollywood liberal establishment, like Paul Newman, who else is a Hollywood liberal establishment?
Yeah.
Ed Asner and
Jane Fonda.
Yeah, Jane Fonda. They came to him and said, you know, you should boycott. Don't go to the dinner at the White House. And I personally thought, you know, I felt that way, but then part of me got self-righteous because I thought, well, if I got invited to the White House for dinner, would I go? You know, it would be such a grist for my satirical mill and to be on in the belly of the monster. But of course, that's such a hypothetical case that I can't even deal with this.
Well, that's what Mortsaw, I saw a thing on TV. He was talking about this very situation.
Uh-huh.
And he was saying, well, after spending the evening there with Reagan, he realizes that Darwin's theory is blown out of the water. Survival of the fittest hasn't occurred in Reagan's case.
Well, except that Reagan is about to reveal that it was Bonzo who first told him about the theory of creationism. So this is the reconciliation between those two.
It sure wasn't Bonzo who started the AIDS. It was some monkey in Africa, wasn't it? Maybe that's how it got started.
Oh, I'll tell you. I saw in the airport Lyndon LaRouche people with signs that said, mosquitoes don't wear condoms. And at first I didn't understand. I thought he was talking about the mosquitoes in Nicaragua, the tribes. But he was talking about AIDS and how in Africa and Florida there are mosquitoes that actually can transmit the AIDS virus. So I had to assure him that it was only if they shared their needles.
Right.
What inspired you to start doing what you're doing?
When you got an itch, you scratch it. it was just a survival for me, you know. I mean, people wake up to the fact that they're Martians at different times in life. I woke up to it early, and I realized that I would have to learn to pass as an Earthling if I wanted to survive. And so I used humor as my vehicle because laughter is what I imprinted on in terms of you know, waking up to the mystery of your own existence. Everybody has that, and some people go back to sleep because the world is just too painful to bear. And so you need to imprint on something to deal with all the pain and the horror that there is in the world to allow you to, you know, to focus on some of the beauty and the pleasure, too. And if you want to be a well-rounded person. And humor became my religion, in effect. I mean, it's just my way of perceiving the world. Everybody has to have a metaphor for the mystery. I mean, because life is a mystery. If it's not a mystery, what the fuck is it? That's my philosophy.
So what's your role? What do you see your role as being?
Oh, I guess I'm sort of court jester of the revolution. Or maybe poppy seed. I'm not sure. It's hard choosing roles.
Well, of all the sages and philosophers,
maybe a sage role, that would be good.
Well, I was going to say, many of the sages and philosophers seem to be political satirists. Who's your favorite, and why?
Well, Lenny Bruce was the one who influenced me the most, because he went all the way. You know, he just, he balanced on the edge, and then he realized that the edge was infinite. And so even though he's dead, you know, I still relate to him as a touchstone for the tradition that I'm trying to carry on, that he was part of.
Who are some of the other major...
Well, Mortzall did, too. I mean, you know, he may be bitter now, mm-hmm. but, you know, he was a pioneer.
Right.
Richard Pryor, Lily Tomlin. There are... you know, I'm influenced. There's a thing that Lenny Bruce said. That's what he said, actually. He had a bad cough.
Right.
He said two things that were... one was that I am part of everything I indict, which I think is important, because we all have a little Oliver North in us. But he said, I am influenced by every waking moment of my life. And so you know, the people whose humor I admire can come from anywhere. I heard about a ghetto kid in Austin, 7 years old, who, when he saw that photograph of Michael Jackson in this health chamber of some sort that... that he wanted to rejuvenate himself in if he ever got old. This kid just effortlessly said, oh, he's just trying to freeze dry his AIDS. That was a 7-year-old ghetto kid.
Wow.
You know, think of the cynicism and the sophistication
right.
that comes from that. Johnny Carson's writers, who get $5,000 a week to write jokes about unemployment, would be hard pressed to come up with those kind of cultural connections.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an awareness that kids have today that they didn't have when I was a kid.
But it also points to your theory of humor as being a self-protective mechanism.
Uh-huh.
You take the things that are most frightening and most threatening, like
uh-huh.
AIDS or Iran-Contra or Oliver North or nuclear weapons,
uh-huh.
and you somehow turn your fear into you overcome your fear.
That's why I said I was so influenced by this 7-year-old kid. I mean, I heard this a couple of days ago, and I've just been thinking about it, the implications of it, because it also means it's a way of the kids saying, one of my interpretations of it is that it's a way of the kid dealing with being a ghetto kid by saying, you know, even Michael Jackson can't protect himself
mm-hmm.
from that kind of fate, if that's what his fate is.
Right.
Paul, you also wrote for Mad Magazine and wrote for Steve Allen. Did you write for Steve Allen first when he was on TV? Is that
this was a freelance basis. The old in the when he had his show on, I did a couple of sketches. I did a song that I wrote and he put the music to called Cosa Nostra. It was a romantic ballad, Our Thing. Had lines about I give you the kiss of death and. Yeah, and Steve Allen has always been, he has a mailing list, I don't know of how many hundreds of people that he sends articles to, Xeroxes of articles that have interested him, you know, about whether it's mafia influence in the Teamsters or Teamster influence in the mafia. although he's kind of, now he's doing some kind of Brand Flakes commercial, you know, I guess it comes out one way or the other.
If you could give America the good news, bad news, what would it be?
Well, that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists periodically publishes on their cover a clock showing how many minutes we are to midnight. Midnight representing total nuclear disaster. And recently they moved it up from 4 minutes to midnight to 3 minutes to midnight. Now I'm not sure what their time scale is, whether a minute represents a month or a year or a decade, but whatever it is, we are now 3 minutes to total nuclear holocaust. So I would say that's the bad news. The good news is that atomic scientists are just as neurotic as the rest of us. They set their clocks 15 minutes ahead. So the good news is really 18 minutes to total nuclear doomsday. We have that extra time to fool around them.
What would you say has been the greatest political prank ever played? Yeah, besides maybe the election of Ronald Reagan 6 years after we turned Nixon out. I mean, yeah, there has to be some other prank.
The greatest political prank ever played. I guess the Bay of Pigs might fit into that category. You know, and I suppose if Kennedy had gotten air cover from the CIA, that would have transformed it from the prank category into the hoax category. Well, I guess the notion that Democrats and Republicans are really that different, I think, is probably the greatest political prank. You know, the illusion of a two-party system, when it's really several parties. You know, the Lockheed Christmas Party, the Northrop Christmas Party. It's a multiple party system.
And when did you begin The Realist? It was 1958. What led you to do this at the end of the McCarthy period and the Eisenhower?
It was the McCarthy period. It was the frustration at MAD that they didn't want anything that wasn't for teenagers.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to do something on unions, in fact, and they said, no, it's too adult, just the subject matter. They wouldn't even look at it. The first thing I saw to MAD was a thing called If Comic Strip Characters Answered Those Little Ads in the Back of Magazines. And I would just write the script, and it was illustrated by Wally Wood, the late Wally Wood, who did the Disneyland and Memorial Orgy in The Realist.
Mm.
when Disney died, I just said, let your imagination flow and show us what would have happened now that these people who no longer have the restraints that Disney put on them, you know, what would these characters do? And so you had Goofy and Minnie Mouse humping on a cash register at Disneyland while Mickey Mouse was shooting up, and Dumbo was defecating on Donald Duck, you know, screaming back at him, and Tinkerbell was doing a striptease for a bunch of people, and Pinocchio's nose got longer as he watched, sort of displaced arousal. But in this article I did for MAD on the things that comic strip characters would answer in the little ads, we had like Little Orphan Annie answering the ad for Maybelline so she could get some makeup on her blank eyes, and Aliyuk getting rid of his superfluous hair. And one of the things was olive oil sending away for falsies, because she was very flat-chested,
right,
objectively speaking.
Right.
And they didn't want to run that. They thought it was funny, but Bill Gaines, the publisher, said to me, look, you know, I know my mother will object to that. And I said, yeah, he was 35 years old at the time. I said, yeah, but, you know, she's not a typical reader of MAD. And he said, no, but she's a typical mother. And so there was that thing, you know, you want to rock the boat, but, you know.
Within limits.
Within the limits, yeah.
So you wanted to go over the limits.
I didn't want to think about limits.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to, I mean, I have my own limits.
Right.
I mean, because I have paradoxes. On one hand, irreverence is my only social cow, my only sacred cow. On the other hand, I don't want the victims to be the target of my humor.
Mm.
So even though I'll talk about AIDS, somebody who is suffering from AIDS is not the target of my humor. The target of my humor is my own fears,
mm-hmm,
and inhibitions and hypocrisies,
mm-hmm,
and by extension those of the audience.
Mm.
The other paradox is that in my own Zen bastard spiritual quest, I try not to judge people, which is pretty bizarre for a social critic. But it's a challenge, because one form of satire is to see things from the point of view of the executioner, you know, because they, as I said before, they have their own logic. And I think the most outrageous thing I ever saw any comedic performer do on stage was when Lenny Bruce took things from the point of view of Adolf Eichmann, sympathetically, you know, trying to say, well, I went to the ovens every day and I looked through the porthole and I saw I had done my job well that day and I went back home. Now, he didn't get many laughs during this, but he did it in a nightclub to an audience which probably had a lot of Jews in it, and I asked him about this later, because when I first interviewed Lenny, he said the function of a comedian is to get a laugh every 15 to 25 seconds. I mean, he was very precise about it. And now he would sometimes go off rambling, you know, and talk about his court cases, and because he always talked about his environment. Now his environment just happened to be paddy wagons and courtrooms more and more. And I said, you're not getting those laughs every 15 to 25 seconds now, Lenny. And he says, well, they said, that was my definition of a comedian. I'm not a comedian, I'm changing. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I'm not a comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce. So he saw himself as a symbolic
that he had assumed a function in society. It wasn't just that he was a comic anymore. He knew that he had become a symbol because in fact, his FBI, I got his FBI files. I got Helen Keller's FBI files, too.
That's right. She was a socialist. Huh?
Well, in fact, there was a great thing. J. Edgar Hoover said that they should keep files on her. In fact, he refused to because she got a birthday card from Helen Gurley Brown. She sent a birthday card to Helen Gurley Brown when she was in prison at the age of 65. So obviously, Helen Keller, deaf, dumb, and blind, was a dangerous subversive.
Helen Gurley Brown was the wobbly one from the IWW, right?
I thought she was the editor of Cosmopolitan.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't know. They're all, they're all interchangeable.
You're right.
Elizabeth
right.
Gurley Flynn, maybe.
Okay, I've got IWW. You know, that's a problem with today's mixed-up world. When you mix up the Wobblies with
Cosmopolitan, that in itself is the kind of political satire.
I know. Yeah. Well, that's the thing, that the attention span, it's so quick that people hear Abby Hoffman now say, isn't she the state senator from Arkansas? You know, it's Amy Carter. I think she's with a new punk group, isn't she? I mean, mm-hmm. people really forget. And yet, the fact that Abby Hoffman and Amy Carter were co-defendants in that CIA recruiting suit, which they won. I went to the victory party. Mm-hmm. And it was very significant because Lenny Weinglass, the attorney for the case, we asked him, what do you think was a turning point in the jury's consciousness? Because that set a great precedent. And he said, well, it was when Ralph McGehee testified, the former football player who was recruited by the CIA right off the playing field and ended up in their assassination squads. And they made the point that in the 60s, they would not have been able to use this necessity defense because the jury wouldn't have believed that the CIA did things like that. But they become jaded and sophisticated enough that they were prepared to believe that kind of testimony.
That's parallel with what John Stockwell, former CIA person who wrote In Search of Enemies, had to say. He would write stuff, and the editors of the book who were looking at it before it was published, they'd say, we can't publish this. Nobody believe it. And Stockwell would say, but it's real. It's what really happened. And they said, no, nobody believed it.
Yeah, I know. In The Realist, I published work by Mae Brussel, who was a conspiracy researcher from Carmel, California. And she, in an article called Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped, she delineated the conspiracy behind the Watergate break-in, which was still being called by the mainstream press a caper, a third-rate burglary. And she named Nixon and L. Patrick Gray and John Mitchell because she had been doing research into the Kennedy assassination since 63. So she saw the same personnel involved. She saw the same modus operandi. And this was 9 months before it actually came out in the mainstream press. And so people then were telling me, you're crazy. They were not prepared to believe it. Mm-hmm. You know, when the truth came out, I felt vindicated. And, you know, they say, well, you know, you were crazy, but you were right. Mm-hmm.
It's probably the same thing with these drugs today, the theories of the Contras being drug runners. A lot of people probably just don't believe this at all. And then eventually the information will come out. Uh-huh. And the critics, like the Christic Institute and yourself and Alternative Views, will be vindicated.
Well, but it's not the key is, it's not just the Contras doing it on their own. They're doing it in relationship with the CIA.
Yeah, that's the point.
Right.
Yeah.
And even George Bush's office.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, George Bush, we're really waiting to come out from behind the bush. I mean, there is a theory that he was the one who gave the go-ahead on the La Penca bombing. This is where Eden Pastore was going to hold a press conference. And it gets confusing to people because they say, well, why would they want to get rid of him? And you have to explain, well, see, he was a Contra, but he wasn't one of our Contras.
He was not unifying with the other groups.
He wasn't following the CIA's orders.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Paul, during the Watergate era, you had a lot of fun satirizing the Nixon administration. How do you see comparisons between the Iran-Contra scandals and hearings and the Watergate affair and hearings? And also from the standpoint of humor, what are the differences that it presents for satirical targeting?
Uh-huh. Oh, well, this came out. There was a humor conference, an international humor conference, and there were five delegates from Russia. And they asked an American performer like me. It was a kind of interesting thing for me as the editor of an American satirical magazine to meet the editor of Krokodil, which is this Russian satirical magazine, but supported by the state there. So they have a lot of humor about absenteeism and productivity. And as one of the, a former editor there who edited the book of Russian underground humor told me, he said that the humor in Crocodile is for the state, it's not for the people. And so I was one of a few people invited to try and make these Russians laugh. And I tried to pick something that would demonstrate freedom of expression in this country. You know, again, that paradox that we have, you know, that political candidates have gotten into office by dint of assassinations that then made it look like they were brought in by a mandate. And yet we have the freedom under the First Amendment to talk about how rotten we are. So I try so the story I told was, in answer to your question, was comparing the Watergate scandal and the Contragate. And there, of course, we had the smoking gun. We had the 18 and a half minutes missing from Nixon's tape, which, of course, General Haig referred to as being caused by sinister forces. I'm telling you, there's a bunch of nuts around that White House. And I've lost the nut vote now. Poor politics. So what do we have comparable to that? You know, in Irangate, we had only the brain surgery on William Casey, where they removed the section from August 1985 to November 1986. So, you know, that I began to get suspicious. And so as I told that story there, it was translated. You know, I would pause, and then the American audience would laugh, and then it would be translated, and the Russians would laugh. And so, you know, they both laughed at that. So it was kind of a unifying humor. And of course now, you know, just the notion of obviously Casey is going to become the scapegoat because dead men don't talk.
Right.
And Poindexter will testify that he reported to Casey. And so we'll never know if Casey reported to Reagan. So it's a very convenient death, you know. And I suspect that soon the Ollie in 88 buttons will be replaced by Who Killed Casey buttons.
I mean, I think that the laugh tracks on TV sitcoms, I know all of them are the lowest form of fascism, and so is Ollie Martin. Yeah, I mean, what is more fascistic than a machine telling you when you have permission to laugh at something, telling you whether or not something is funny? And what it does, it changes your nervous system. If you hear it long enough, then you hear something on TV that you think is funny, but there's no laugh track, and you find yourself waiting a split second for that sound to give you permission. And so it affects you. I saw a Phil Donahue show, and he asked this question, what does the Bible have to say about vibrators? Now, I mean, maybe this is a serious theological discussion. Well, from Ecclesiastes, there was a time for manual dexterity, there was a time for the vibrators. Then I saw the hearings, the parole hearing of Sirhan Sirhan, and there was a woman on the parole board who said, Mr. Sirhan, let me ask you a question. He said, oh, please, that's not necessary. Call me Sirhan. Again. Be sure if obsequiousness was part of his religious tradition, he's silly. I mean, happy Lord, Sirhan, Sirhan. Or with a little name, Sirhan, be Sirhan. Happy Lord, Sirhan, be Sirhan.
Name one or two or three people in America today that are relevant that people can learn from.
Anybody they meet, you know, everybody you meet is relevant and you can learn from.
What's Paul Krassner's next goal?
What's my next goal? To be a champion hockey player. What's my next goal? Or maybe a circus giant. I can't decide. Maybe I should take a vocational aptitude test. I mean, there's projects. You know, I want to continue editing The Realist and performing and doing freelance writing, but I want there's a few books I want to put together. One's a collection of pieces that I've done. It would either be called Murder at the Humor Convention or I Snorted Cocaine with the Pope. I mean, one's a kind of classy title, the other's a little bit more commercial. And then as another is an autobiography, which is unauthorized. I'm writing it against my better judgment. And then the other is a novel based on a controversial comedian that was inspired by Lenny. So, you know, there are projects that I wanted to do. But there are so many unknowns, you know, that I guess my chief goal is to act as if process itself were my goal. And then it saves a lot of disappointment, you know, if you get hit by the bus just before your book comes out.
You know, the world is such a weird old place anymore. I was in a sitting with my mother a few weeks ago, overlooking the Grand Canyon, and she was just sitting there taking in all the grandeur, and she said, "Sometimes I wonder if I'm actually sitting here or I'm in a Cinerama movie house." And we started thinking, yeah, there is such a blurred line between reality and the media and fantasy. And it started me thinking about, well, what a real weird world this is. For instance, politically, during the Reagan years, we had a president who couldn't tell reality from fantasy and from movie scripts. And then some of the books, some of the articles you see about what Dan Quayle and George Bush say, you wonder whether they're actually written or whether they're actually quoting these people. Well, I saw that one of the latest ones by Dan Quayle, and I thought, God, whoever wrote that was really funny. And then I found out it was true. Dan Quayle actually did say, after returning from a trip from Latin America, saying, "Gosh, I sure wish I'd have studied Latin in high school and college so I'd be able to converse with those people in that part of the world." And then you read satire, like from Paul Krassner, satire, a political and social economic satire, and it makes you wonder, hey, is he making this up, or are these things that really happen? So what does it say about the world now? You philosophers have been dealing, and what is reality? What does it say when the world gets to the place where reality and satire are the same? Of course, some people, they take a flight into religion, so they're just going from the real world into fantasy world. So what's the difference between the psychotics and the so-called nut houses and the people on the street? I saw a guy the other day, he said, "I am not a robot. I only talk like a robot. I am actually Jesus Christ talking like a robot." Well, maybe it was Dan Quayle. Who knows? But even in the news, you look at a news story, for instance, in Seattle. Safeway actually hired workers to picket their stores during a recent strike. Isn't that weird? Now, what's happening? Well, it seemed that the food and commercial workers struck against several Seattle area supermarket chains, but they decided to let the Safeway stores stay open and not picket them so the people could go ahead and get food and not have to cross a picket line. Well, the people in Safeway, they felt threatened by this. They felt left out. So they thought the unions were misleading the public, and so they hired a bunch of people to carry signs to picket Safeway. And then they also took out ads in the papers urging customers to shop at their regular stores, not come into Safeway. And in the world of music, what we see isn't real. There's been lip syncing to the songs in movies for years. We know that. We go see these old movies and we see them just pantomiming to the songs. But they even do it now on TV shows and on MTV. Obviously, nobody can sing while they're spinning around and jumping up and down like that. But now they got even further. I was talking to a person connected with the music industry and about concerts, and I was talking with her about lip syncing. And she said the music is so electronically enhanced nowadays that not only are the words lip synced, but the whole band is pretending to play their instruments. So people go and they see the band, and they hear the tape of the music. So it's really, really a weird world. But of course, the only real thing is alternative views. We bring you all the real stuff. That's what's really happening in the world. And of course, we're labeled as radical because all we're dealing in is, hey, here's what's happening. So if reality is radical, and radical we're constantly being told is bad and we should stay away from it, then that means reality is bad. So it leads to a psychotic society if we're supposed to live in this fantasy world of things we're told by the politicians and by the media. But of course, we're real here. Maybe.
Hmm.
We're real as we're sitting here and talking, but what you people are seeing when you're watching TV, you're not seeing us. This is all you're seeing. This is reality, this video cassette. And what is actually, we don't exist. We're just a bunch of electronic squiggles on the videotape. So even we're not real. I think I've lived too long.
That brings us to the end of another Alternative Views.
Oh, wait a minute. You promised there'd be nothing edited out. Wait, that's all. Okay. No, shut up.
If you're up to reading The Realist, Paul Krassner's publication, write to P.O. Box 1230, Venice, California, 90294. Also, you can inquire about his new book, The Best of the Realist.
Not to that, I always wanted to do that, put my hand up to the camera. Okay, that's it. Interview is over.
We'd like to thank the people who participated in making the Paul Krassner interview. Of course, the producer and the director, Robert Wilkinson. The technical crew was Rick Echternach, C.E. Krask, Robert Rober, and A.I. Thorin. And the program was edited by Rick. We'd also like to thank the people who helped make our production possible. Brian Lynch was our director, set the lights, did the audio. And for our news section, Eric Eubank was our camera person, and Kevin L. West was our audio man. Rob Whittison helped out in editing, and of course we always thank Austin Community Television, ACTV, for the use of their equipment. Many people have asked us to give the names and addresses of the publications which we use for news and other source material. The Udney Reader is the Reader's Digest of the left. P.O. Box 1974, Marion, Ohio, 43305. The American Atheist is good for keeping up with church-state relationships and the religious right wing. P.O. Box 2117, Austin, Texas, 78768-2117. Al-Fajr Palestinian Weekly provides information on what is happening in Israel from the Palestinian point of view. 16 Crowell Street, Hempstead, New York, 11550. Texas 78713.